Good evening, honourable members, ladies and gentlemen. We are about to start the meeting. Apology for starting an hour later. It was expected that the sitting of the National Assembly would end by 5 p.m. Unfortunately, due to various reasons that took place in the sitting this afternoon, there's been unfortunate delays and we could not start until the Assembly rose. The agenda has been distributed, as well as the minutes of the previous meeting. I received two apologies. One apology from the Honourable Maseko. She's on study leave and cannot attend. The second apology is an apology from Dr. Mulder of Freedom from PAS, who has given a verbal apology to the Secretary of the Committee. And I must once again reiterate that as the outstanding operations, all the members of the Committee, including those who decided not to participate further in the proceedings of the Committee, are informed of the meetings when it takes place, and the meetings are also, of course, published on the Gazette of Committees. So everyone has been informed that this meeting is taking place. The draft agenda in front of us is essentially to consider firstly the draft minutes and thereafter the final report of the committee. There's just one item, honourable members, before I put the agenda formally to the meeting that I want to include. Just after the draft minutes, it's correspondence that has been received so that we reflect it in our deliberations. And I get somebody to move the adoption of the amended agenda, Honourable Beekman, and seconded by the Honourable Ngobo. We then go to the minutes of the 30th of October 2014. We'll first check the minutes in terms of its correctness, page by page, and thereafter we'll adopt these minutes. On page 1. Change in attendance register. Any corrections on page 2? Any corrections on page 3? Any corrections on page 4? If there are no corrections to be effected to the minutes, can I get a member to move for the adoption of these minutes as a true reflection of the meeting of the 30th, Honourable Ngobo, and seconded by the Honourable Slapude. Are there any minutes arising out of these minutes, Honourable Members? Any minutes arising? The meeting essentially dealt with a presentation from the technical team responsible for drafting the report, and it dealt with the observations and preliminary discussion on the findings and also possible recommendations in terms of the work of the committee. So if there's no matters arising, we can proceed to the next item on the agenda. As I've indicated, there is correspondence that I've received from the leader of the opposition, Honourable Maimane. And the Honourable Maimane in the correspondence essentially requests a copy of the draft report that is currently under consideration by the committee. And he indicates that although he and his party withdrew out of the meeting, they still see themselves as lawful members of the committee. I have thus instructed the staff earlier today to send a copy of the report that was considered by the committee in last week's meeting to the Honourable Maimane, and to also indicate that all our meetings are open to the public, it's open to the media, and that the report that was dealt with as a public document is indeed not a secret that should not be shared with anyone. So that report was sent off to the members of the opposition. Is there any comment, any member? Honourable Kubai?
Thanks, Chairperson, and I appreciate you bringing the letter for our attention. I think where I'm sitting, I'm really concerned in the manner that opposition parties will conduct themselves in this parliament. If a member, let me start in terms of the rules, because my understanding is that any member of parliament is entitled to be part of a committee. No one has blocked them from participating in the committee, and they still have that access, including even those that do not, their membership were not allocated based on the party representation in the small system in parliament. But what is worrying is a conduct where you find that people want to run things parallel to what procedures of parliament are. I'm saying this, Chair, because none or never in a time where you find a person decides to leave discussions and processes and then demand a report somewhere. Equally so, what he's saying that he's entitled to the report, like any other member of parliament is entitled to this report. But he can only be entitled to a report of the committee because the report that is currently before us is in a draft state, is still being reconsidered, being worked on. I'm trying to understand the logic why he wants this report, because people who want to have the report is because they want to enhance it and participate so that we can have a final report. And just, that's what I'm saying, Chair, I just find it difficult because I don't think we are working constructively to build the parliament and to support democracy and to support the work of this parliament. Because at some point, they had a press briefing somewhere in Rosebank promising to release a minority report and not recognizing the work that we are doing here. We've been sitting here day in, day out, exhausted by this way because we understood our responsibilities as members of parliament of what we need to do and have adjudicated the responsibilities. That's what I'm trying to understand, Chairperson. Honorable Maimane, if you want to participate in the process, you must come back to the committee and have the discussions with us because we are not going to be engaged by Honorable Maimane in the streets or through the media. If they have issues they want to engage us with, through the processes of parliament, they must come to the committee and raise, because that's what I'm trying to understand. Why would you ask for a report if it's not for the purpose of engaging? Because it's a draft report. The report that we are going to conclude as a committee is going to be a committee report that goes to parliament, and all members of parliament will have access to it. There will be a debate in the National Assembly. They will participate in the debate. I think, Chairperson, we really have to stop entertaining this sideline issues. Therefore, I really appreciate you bringing it here, but I think we need to be really firm. People must not play games here. We are here doing work. We are not bored. We do not lack something else to do. We are here because we understand our duties, we understand our responsibilities. They must not take us for granted.
Well, thank you, Honourable Member. I don't want to open debate on the matter. Suffice to say that I did instruct the staff earlier today to send a copy of the report that was considered in the last meeting. I've just seen before this meeting the report for this meeting, and that's why all of you have just been searched for copies of those reports. I want to get into the issue of consideration of the draft report that's currently in front of us. You will recall in the last meeting there were a number of proposals that were made by honourable members of this committee in terms of the section of the report dealing with observations. There's a long list of issues, and there have been changes made to the report. Before I get to the second part, that will essentially be a short presentation from the legal staff of parliament that is attached to this committee. We'll have an input on some of the matters that was flagged in the last meeting, and I requested legal services to develop an appropriate draft for us and input into this meeting that we also want to deal with before we get into the issue of findings and recommendations. So we start by giving an opportunity to the technical team that's drafting the report to just focus on those areas of the report that has been substantially enhanced based on the contributions that have been made by members of the committee. And when you do that, can you just reflect the pages? I don't want to go observation again through all those scriptures. I want to focus on those areas where the announcement took place.
Okay, Chair. Good afternoon, honorable members. Chairperson, one of the first areas, Chair, that we had to do extra work on is on page 8, Chairperson, under observations. And it carries on up to page 9. So it's from point 1 to 7. With your permission, Chair, I would go from 1 to 7 then, from page 8 to 9. Chairperson, it is precursed with a heading just like did in the previous draft. And perhaps just before I continue, Chair, with a specific one, members may notice that this particular report has a footnote. Team was instructed by the Chair that we rather include footnotes so that we know which report we are busy with. Now, unfortunately, the first report, the draft report, does not have that footnote, but we will certainly in future copies of that particular one have it as version 1. This one's version, ad hoc version 2 of the 6th of the 11th, 2014. So, Chairperson, the heading of this one, as we did with the previous one, describes what the matter is from 1 to 7. It says, the matter of precedence, the status of the public protector's report, remedial actions at a High Court, Western Cape Division, judgment regarding the public protector as ombudsman. Members know the context of this particular one, Chair, so I will not, I'll leave it to members to, during deliberation, deal with that. Number one, the committee noted that when the public protector has submitted reports to the National Assembly in 2001, and that report is Public Protector Report number 13, February 2001, closed bracket, and in 2004, referring to Public Protector's Special Report to Parliament, dated May 2004, closed bracket, Parliament established ad hoc committees to deal with the matters of investigation. Two, the committee noted that in both cases, in processing its work, both committees did not call witnesses to give evidence, but instead used the contents of the reports and communications serving before it as evidence. Only where absolute need arose to gather clarity on matters did the ad hoc committees enter into written communication with the Office of the Public Protector. The committee therefore applied the principle of precedence, stare decisis, close brackets, and focused on the content of the investigative reports that served as source documents before it, rather than initiating its own in-depth investigation into the matter. Three, the committee further noted...
Can you just hold it, please?
Sorry, Chair.
Honourable Beckman?
If we just want to amend, can we do that?
Yes, do it, Tom.
Maybe, thank you, Chairperson. Yeah, thank you very much for the report from the legal advisors. Maybe just, I think, maybe the context of the last meeting. Content advisors. Remember we mentioned in the previous meeting, we referred specifically to the 2004 report, where no witnesses was called. So that was the basis. We didn't refer in that regard to the 2001 report, so that can just be correct.
So both one, paragraph 1 and 2. The points 1 and 2 must be amended accordingly. Members agree? We may proceed to the third bullet point.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Honourable Beckman. Chair number 3, the committee further noted that the outcome in the High Court of South Africa in the matter between the Democratic Alliance and the South African Broadcasting Corporation, between brackets the case number 12497/2014, bracket, was of relevance to the matter that it was mandated to investigate. This judgment stressed the importance of the Office of the Public Protector as one of six institutions established by the Constitution, strengthen democracy through their independence, impartiality, and the exercise of their powers without fear, favor, and prejudice. 5, the committee noted that...
We can just hold there, Chair. Number 3, the committee further noted and ended with mandated to investigate. This committee was not mandated to investigate. It was mandated to consider reports.
Sorry, Chair, on 3 as well, broadcasting, SABC broadcasting, we can just what it's called.
Thank you, Chair. 5, the committee noted that, in addition, the judgment provided clarity with regards to the findings and remedial actions of the Office of the Public Protector as stated that the, and we quote, powers and functions of the public protector are not adjudicative, close quote, and that, quote, again, open quote, a finding of public protector is not binding on persons and organs of the state, close quote. That comes from page 32.51 of the judgment that is made in reference to section 182(1) of the Constitution. 6, the committee observed that the above mentioned judgment first stated that the power to take remedial action as described in section 182(1) of the Constitution, and we're quoting from the Constitution, means no more than that the public protector may take steps to redress improper or prejudicial conduct, but that it is not to say that the findings of the public protector are binding and enforceable, or that the institution is ineffective without such powers, close quote. And again, we are quoting, Chair, there may be some confusion. We are not quoting from the Constitution, we're quoting from the judgment, Chair. 7, the committee further noted that the investigative reports produced by the Interministerial Task Team, Joint Standing Committee on Intelligence, and the Special Investigation Unit, Investigating Unit, all contained findings and recommendations, but that specifically the latter legislatively could initiate punitive legal action to ensure redress and remedial action. Chair, I will pause because that is the end of that particular one, unless you want me to continue with the others.
Well, let me ask for comment from the members of the committee, the Honourable Chair. Just switch on your mic and then speak into it, please.
I think the situation is well captured. I just think that on paragraph 4, maybe you see the Constitution establishes institutions not to strengthen democracy through independence and impartiality, but it gives them the power to investigate maladministration, prejudice, as stated in the Constitution. But impartiality, independence is very important, because that is the one that guarantees them to do that work without fear and fame. So if you can just look at the formulation, but try and capture the mandate as captured in the Constitution. Amen.
Honourable Beckman?
Sorry, Chair, to take you back to paragraph 1. I think just for completeness sake, that we refer also in the third line to the Public Protector Special Report number 26. Let's just give that specific reference.
I also specifically requested the legal advisor is on his way, who also look at this judgment, because there was a perception that this was an interpretation by the committee of what the powers of public protector is in terms of the Public Protector Act in the Constitution. And it was also drawn to my attention that in fact this is not the first court that has pronounced on the matter. Hello, Macheka.
It's quite correct. There was a decision of the Supreme Court of Appeal. Now, that court said that the public protector falls within a category of ombudsman, but that in the South African situation, the public protector has more power in the sense that she is not supposed to wait for someone to refer a matter to her. She can, on her own initiative, investigate into a matter. The court used the word the powers of proaction, but that did not confer adjudicative powers on her, and it also did not elevate her powers to the same powers as that of a court of law, which would hand down decisions that are binding and enforceable. So I think that the finding of the Western Cape High Court is correct, and also it has to be understood fully, because it doesn't simply say her powers, her remedial actions are not binding and enforceable. It goes on to say they cannot be ignored. And that means, therefore, that if you do not agree with, you must have cogent and rational reasons for doing so. So the court requires that whoever disagrees must engage and have those reasons. And I think to conclude, Chairperson, that's what is happening in this process, because once the report reached Parliament, Parliament tried to appoint a committee to engage with those findings, and hence the work of this committee. I think what we are doing here is in line with the decision of the Western Cape High Court.
I would request the technical team to do is when Edward Venara steps in, because I think the judge, when he delivered that judgment, also reflected on the Supreme Court of Appeal, on what the Supreme Court of Appeal said on the previous instance, is to include that word section and then redraft the areas, especially under bullet 4, and also the other amendments that were made by the Honourable Beerman to that section. Can you take us to the next area there where substantial changes have taken place? I want to remind also the members that you will see that, and that is the status of what the draft report says. It's exactly a draft, subject to change. So those who wish to quote out of the draft report run the risk that they will be contradicted at a later stage. May I continue?
Chairperson, thank you. I can just say, Chair, that one of the major changes we made to the report, major for us because it was a lot of work, was to actually go through every single reference. And we will continue to do so, Chair, because we want to make sure that every reference is actually referring to, if we make a statement about something, that reference actually is relevant to it, because we found a few that were weak. So that is one of the things that we were doing and are still doing in the process. Chairperson, the next one is on page 16, that refers to the head of cabinet, the president and cabinet that acted with urgency to deal with the serious allegations related to the project to secure his private residence in Acton Kanda.
Sure.
So that's on page 16, Chair.
Good. Yes, Honourable Member.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think the subheading should read as follows. The President, not with her cabinet, the President acted with agency to deal with the serious allegation related to the project to secure his private residence in Uganda. Thanks, Chair.
Just keep in mind that the report in terms of the House resolution that was referred to us, is a report by the President and not a report by the President and Cabinet. So we're dealing with the report of the President, and so the correct reference must be made. Can I continue?
It starts on page 16, Chair, and will continue on at the top, page 17, 45.6. It reads as follows. 42. Following sustained media allegations that the President used state funds to build his private residence at Nkala, under the leadership of the President, as head of Cabinet, a number of consistent actions indicate the serious commitment by government to deal with the matter in a transparent manner. 43. These actions by the President as head of the National Executive, we have between brackets section 83 of the Constitution, close brackets, took place in addition to the investigation that the Public Protector undertook and reported on in Secure in Humford, dated 19 March 2014.
Just to interrupt you again, under 42, is to effect an amendment and remove serious commitment, because that's not been the step taken.
We are removing from indicate to commitment. So it reads, following sustained media allegations that the President used state funds to build his private residence at Nkandla, and leadership of the President as head of Cabinet, a number of consistent actions by government to deal with the matter, we will fix it, Chair. Now the sentence is a bit wonky, but we will strengthen it up.
And also under with your heading, where you refer to the urgency. These are observations, and we must guard against introducing impetus to something that an assessment is still to be made on. So urgency is not the correct word to be used. That also must be amended.
Thank you.
It's to deal with the serious allegations.
Chair, we continue with 44. Each of the investigations resulted in reports that included findings and remedial actions that cannot be ignored. 45. The investigations and reports can be recorded chronologically as follows. So even before going through them, they go up to 45.6. I must just mention here that some of the communication between the President and the National Assembly Speaker has not been listed here, and we already earlier on, my colleague and I said that it should be part of this here. 45.1. On 5 October, the Minister of Public Works announced...
Can you include the year, please?
Yes. It's one of 2012, Jim. We knew about that, Jose. We were just looking at one another in arrangement and how we forgot. 5 October 2012, the Minister of Public Works announced that an investigation into the allegations will take place by a specially convened security cluster task team. On 20 December 2013, the President signed Proclamation R59 of 2013 for the Special Investigation Unit to investigate the matter and, where relevant, institute civil action to recover any state funds that might have been lost due to possible corrupt activities. 3. The Interministerial Task Team reported on its finding, on its investigation on 27 January 2013. 4. The Public Protector's reports, Cure in Comfort, were made public on 19 March 2014. It was submitted to Parliament by the President, adhering to Chapter 9 of the Constitution, who noted the report of the Public Protector, its findings and recommendations, and responded to a letter addressed to the Speaker of Parliament on the 2nd of April 2014. This was published in the announcement tabling committee reports document on the 2nd of April, page 2418. 45.5.
Yes, member.
I think
we can hear you.
I think we call the speaker of the National.
Thank you, Chairperson. This is one of the errors that we were working on, please, Chair, and that I mentioned. We may find the word Parliament instead of National Assembly here, because this committee does not fall under the National Council of Provinces, it's just National Assembly.
Now let's just be consistent throughout the document.
We'll do that
to the National Assembly and to Parliament.
We'll fix all of that up. 45.5. The President in this letter stated that he had requested the Special Investigation Unit to provide him with a provisional report of its investigation as soon as possible in order to assist him in providing Parliament with a further final report. Now that is a reference to the same ATC chair. 45.6. We are on page 17. On 14 August...
Yes, remember. Sorry, Chair, I didn't take you back. But I think also, just to be consistent, on page 2 we refer to the Inter-Ministerial Task Team report, and between brackets also to refer to the Security Cluster report, but then in 45.1 we say the Special Convened Security Cluster Task. So I think let's refer to what we said in 2, otherwise this may be a different, you know, animal, so let's keep it consequent right throughout.
Thank you very much, Chair. Absolutely, we agree with that fully, Chair. We are in the process of doing that. 14 August 2014, the President, we are 45.6, page 17. The President provided a further report to Parliament on the efforts he and the government as collective had made, and were busy making to ensure that whatever state funds might have been lost due to the security upgrade could be identified and recovered, and that persons who were implicated through evidence were brought to book. Chair, I pause and again want to link up with what I said before we start from page 60. There were further communication between the President or from the President on this matter that should be included in the subject in subsections from 45.6 onwards here, and we will add that to the report.
In our area where substantial changes were effected.
Jefferson, just on page 18, the comparative findings across investigative reports. In the previous report, we left open, we left blank actually, some of the tables under the SIU, and that is not acceptable. So what we did was to actually state that they are blank because they are not applicable, but the word not applicable has been added there because that was just not the problem. Chair, we're going to page 23. And we're actually starting with the findings, Chair.
Now, before you get into findings, I want to find out from the other members, is there any other area under observations that you have reflected upon that requires further attention or enhancement? Yes, Honourable Member.
Thank you, Jefferson. I think for my side, it's just to regard them as technical, more starting from, okay, let me just say, the consistency, and I think maybe that's what, when they clean up the document, will ask us, but I pick up all their headings. There are times where you can't follow what it's saying properly. And I'll make an example. When you look at page 13, for example, material conditions in Canada that influence security upgrades. So it doesn't say following, those are the issues that are there. So it's like headings that are standing alone. I'm not sure if I'm making sense to them. So that at least when you read the report, the chronicle or the sequence, that the heading then, therefore, the issues that follow downwards are what you referred to. Because remember, your numbering throughout the document is sequencing throughout, so it doesn't start from there. So it's going to help us when you say, for example, 50s of financial controls are constitutionally prescribed, and then you say, no, you know, so that somebody who's reading a document who's not been part of this can be able to assist us, or can be able to make sense of the report itself. That's one thing, Chair. I don't know if other colleagues.
Honourable Bergman.
No, thank you, Chair. Please just maybe to give the full details on page 22. Page 22, yes, 6-2. The matter of the security. The sentence read, the committee observed that only two of the last steps set out in the cabinet memorandum of 2003 were followed. I think we must indicate those two steps that were followed. That's material. And then I think we must maybe indicate, you know, all the steps that were not taken. There were only four, but also the others. In terms of what was the role of the various executive members in this whole process. I think that's material also to the, you know, to be complete in terms of the report.
Honourable Zakuria.
Still on the observation, maybe I can just make a general comment to say that the way in which the security upgrade at the president's private residence was handled is a serious concern to the committee, and the way in which it was implemented and those who were supposed to monitor the implementation decided to do things unlike what they were supposed to do is a serious concern to this committee, Jefferson. We are not sure of whether the president is secured or not. And the way in which the private residence of the president is always shown on the media leaves much to be desired if he is really secured. And secondly, Jefferson, the issue of using contractors without the necessary documentation and everything is a serious, serious concern for this committee. So we really think that, we really believe that this work was not properly done, and it opens a loophole for state funds looting. And also the way in which the contractors and consultants charged or escalated the prices. It's a real serious concern. So for us, we need to, when we come to recommendation, we really need to say something about this, because we cannot allow state funds to be looted like that. We really need to find a way in which we can deal with this thing to prevent such things from happening in future, because this is not the first and the last security upgrade on the residences of the president or executive and future deputy presidents. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Mendes. Honourable Kubai.
There's just one thing. The last paragraph, the one that before when you said something, 4.5.6. I'm just checking, Chair, shouldn't we list, when we say the, I'm reading that paragraph, obviously remember we are basing, this is our observation based on...
Which paragraph is it?
Paragraph 3.1745.6.
Page? 17.
Paragraph 45.6.
Okay.
The one that was on 14 August 2014. The President provided a further report to Parliament on the efforts he and the government as collectives had made and were busy making to ensure that whatever the state funds might have been lost due to security upgrades could be identified and recovered, and that persons who were implicated through evidence were brought to book. Because we are giving observation, I'm not so sure, I could be wrong, but I thought maybe we would even list those. I don't know if they are there in the document, so that you substantiate the paragraph, not the observation. Either you can even do by referencing.
Yeah, I think by referencing.
One of the things you can do referencing of it, which gives, when a person reads this, it's not something that we have made it up. It's something that somebody would be able to reference to a particular document.
Hello, Vashekha.
Just to amplify the point correctly made by Honorable Tlhakude, that, you know, the securing the residence of the president is a constitutional matter. And the cabinet memo, which was the source of the authority used in this matter, was actually giving effect to that constitutional responsibility. So if we follow what Honorable Tlhakude say, to say we are not even sure that the president is proper secure, so we must really look at those prescripts and see if there was a negligence in complying with them or if they are not properly followed, because it has to be ensured that the president is securely.
Yes, no, but with respect, Honorable Vachekha, that is more a finding that you're moving into terrain where there is an observation that has been made by the Honorable Tlhakude correctly, but you are now moving into the terrain of the finding. Can we just hold to that part? So hold that when we get there. I want to give an opportunity, unless there's any other members who want to interact on this point or on the observations. So, Honorable Member.
To explain in terms of duty of the authority, of the administration people, and the responsibility of the people. The duty of the executive member and the duty of the administrative member in the project.
I don't know if the legal advisor will be able to respond to it immediately, but in the report there is a section that deals with accountability. On the one end, executive accountability, and then also the accountability and responsibilities of the accounting officers, and what is expected from both the executive head of the department, the politician, and what is expected from the accounting officer. The content advisors can just probably reflect for us in which paragraph that is reflected.
Yeah, I know. I can't remember the page now, but I know that it's got a heading that refers to divisions of responsibility that that the Public Finance Management Act it's put in place.
It's on the same page. Page 10.
It's on page 10, and it actually does deal with a question that the Honourable Member is raising. Page 10.12 starts with it. But 13 specifically, Chair, and 14 refers to, and I will read 13, maybe I should read 12.
No, do 13.
13. Okay, 13 refers to the political head. In the Act, it refers to the political head as the executive authority. And it states that that executive authority held the responsibility for matters of policy, while the administrator's head, referred to in the Act as the accounting officer, held the responsibility to implement the department's budget and human resources that is then used, it's not written like that, to translate policy into concrete outcomes. So if I may just, the way in which it's done is the administration would then take a policy and turn it into programs. And programs would then consist out of projects to which money is allocated and staff who are properly capacitated are allocated to actually work to get the policy outcome achieved, concretely achieved, so that people can benefit. It's in a nutshell, Chair, what that is all.
Okay. You see,
we usually deal with these accounting offices and the ministers who are the political heads of these departments. It allows the legal advisor to make an input, a very specific input on undue benefit that arises in these reports. That's why I asked him to be here specifically to deal with that matter. We'll come back to this thing of who is accountable for what, especially in light of the cabinet memorandum of 2003. Keep in mind, account officers do not sit in cabinet, it's politicians in there. Advocate Nara, you have given me a legal opinion, it's quite a few pages. I may say, and honourable members, this was developed because it's a matter that we need to deal with, dealing specifically with the two reports that talk about undue enrichment and how they arrive at those reports at that point. And I engage Advocate Nara, who is part of the technical team of the committee, to develop a legal opinion for me, a finding of undue enrichment. If we can make such a finding, can the committee arrive at the point where we say that there is undue enrichment disproven, and also the processes that led up to such a finding in the reports that are in front of us. But let us give you the opportunity to just briefly talk us through. Unfortunately, there is only one copy that Advocate Nara has given me. It is a confidential copy. It's a legal opinion that was developed. And I will give the members of the committee later a sight of the document. Advocate Nara, you can take us through the document, please.
Thank you, Chair. Good evening to the honourable members. I don't know, in view of the fact that some honourable members do not have a copy of this opinion, if it would do justice for me to do a high-level presentation, or which is why I suggest that I, in detail, take the committee through the opinion, so that the honourable members could get the benefit of some of the submissions that I make and the legal authorities that I use to support the submissions that I do make.
Honourable Kubai?
Sorry, sir, can we get copies just quickly so that we will be able to follow properly?
Okay. I'll allow me to continue with the documents.
Yes.
In this, for the sake of time, there are members who have indicated that they want to go. Do you have copies with you? Okay. He's got copies for you. My apologies, Advocate. There's 5 more copies required.
Thank you, Chair. Honourable members would like to take you to paragraph 2, sorry, to page 2, and it is paragraph 1 of the opinion. That paragraph just gives the background confirmation that I received instructions from the Chair, and specifically to advise on whether, on the basis of this unprotected report that is before the committee, a finding of undue enrichment in respect of the upgrades at the president's private residence could be made by the committee. That is basically the request. It's important because whatever is said in the opinion is trying to respond to that particular question. On page 3 of the opinion,
start by giving a background. The request is informed by the finding in the Public Protector's Report number 25 of 2013-2014, which is entitled Securing Comforts. Honourable members would recall that in that report there are some upgrades that have been effected in the President's residence that in the view of the Public Protector they do not constitute security upgrades, and that others do constitute security upgrades. Further, the committee wanted to further know whether the issue or the question of how one go about law to determine value of undue enrichment. So those were basically two issues which are identified in paragraph 4 of the legal opinion in page 3. So what I'm trying to answer here is whether on the Public Protector's Report a civil claim based on undue enrichment could be successfully pursued. Secondly, how the quantum is determined in an undue enrichment claim. This is us, specifically in view of the cost escalations that have been identified in all the four reports that the committee has considered. Before I deal with this issue of undue enrichment, I'd like to give a context of the basis of civil claims in South Africa. Currently, I mean, the law provides for three bases. You could bring your civil claim basing it on contracts. This would be an instance where parties enter into an agreement to provide certain services or deliver particular goods. And for some other reason, one of the parties default. And one is not happy as a result thereof, and sues based on a breach of contract. The second base would be a judicial liability, a judicial claim, which is roughly a civil wrong. Your vehicle is backed, an example would be your vehicle is backed in a parking lot, I come, I reverse into it, I cause damage, and either negligently or intentionally you suffer damage, and you then base your claim against me based on debt. You will realize that these two claims are based on what we call fault, the fault element. It is either negligence or intention. The third basis would be founded on undue enrichment. Undue enrichment, I would note that in paragraph 5, I refer it to a no-fault claim. In other words, the plaintiff does not have to point any wrong or wrongful conduct, any fault, whether intentional or negligent, on your part to be successful with this claim. On paragraph 6, I make mention of the four reports that have been considered by the committee, and that of those four reports, only the report of the Public Protector made a finding of payment of a portion of in respect of some of the non-secured upgrades. However, I need to be clear that the finding for payment in the Public Protector's Report is not based on undue enrichment. It's rather based on the fair reliance on the national or the effects of the National Key Point Act. I move to page 4 of the opinion. And paragraph 7, The two questions that have been posed, the first one deals with the merits. In other words, when you sue, you say the defendant, the person that you want to claim money from, has done this, and therefore you suffered damage in X amount. Now, before you get to proving the X amount, you must first establish the basis of your claim, that is on the merits. You must first establish whether or not you do have a claim. So, in what is to follow, the focus is firstly on what is that one needs to prove, the requirements around the on the merits of an undue enrichment claim. On paragraph 7, I mentioned those four requirements for an undue enrichment claim. Namely, I refer to the defendant. The defendant is the person against whom we're seeking to recover money. The plaintiff is the person intending to recover money. The defendant must have been enriched. That is the first requirement. The second requirement is that the plaintiff must be impoverished. Third requirement is that the defendant's enrichment must have been at the plaintiff's expense. And the fourth one is that the enrichment must not be unjustified in law. The authorities for that you'll find in Cool Granite Operations Pty Limited, there's Catering Ltd. This is 2003, Volume 5, SA 193. This is the Supreme Court of Appeal judgment, specifically in paragraph 17. In further reading, MacArthur Retails, RTD, versus Short Distance Carriers, CC. CC means Close Corporation. This is 2001, Volume 3, SA 482. Again, this is the Supreme Court of Appeal judgment, paragraph 2. How do you go about proving these four requirements? Who must prove these four requirements? The onus is on the plaintiff to prove on a balance of probabilities that the defendant has been enriched at his or her expense. The defendant then bears the onus of proving either that the enrichment is justified whether the extent of the enrichment is not as claimed by the plaintiff. Again, the authority for that you find in Kudu Granite, as well as the Africa Diamond Exporters Pty Ltd. versus Barclays Bank International Ltd. This is a 1978 volume 36679. This appellate court decision at page 713. And I'd like to draw the committee's attention to what Mallard J.A., as he then was, said in respect of his matter, relying heavily on the book of Professor DeForce. He said the following, paragraph H. I agree with the view stated by Professor DeForce that where plaintiff has proved an overpayment recoverable by conditio indebiti, the onus rests on the defendant to show that he was in fact not enriched at all, was only enriched to the part of what was received. Coming back then to what happened in the current case, we can go to look at the current situation. If there were to be a claim arising out of this undue enrichment, the state would, of course, have to be the plaintiff. So all were said in respect of the burden of proof and the elements that has to be proved. It has to be proved by the state. And you will then realize why this is important on the merits. In this case, the basis of undue enrichment would then have to rest on whether or not some of the enhancements, security or the enhancements could be classified as security enhancement. In other words, if it's found that certain of the security enhancements and the upgrades are security enhancements, then we could say there has been enrichment. But whether or not that's the case here, we need to look on the facts. On the facts that I've considered, starting from paragraph 12, page 5 of the opinion, note, I say, what follows, I consider some of what the public protector regards as non-security features and their reasons, therefore. At page 429 of her report, the public protector finds that, and I want to quote these paragraphs, 10.3.1, she says, I quote, a number of measures, including buildings and other items constructed and installed by the DPW at the president's press residence, went beyond what was reasonably required for security. 10.3.2, the measures that should never have been implemented, as they are neither provided for in the regulatory instruments, particularly the cabinet policy of 2003, the minimum physical security standards, and the sub-security evaluation reports, nor reasonable as the most cost-effective to meet incidental security needs. Now that I have underlined for emphasis purposes, they include the construction inside the president's residence, and she goes and mentions them as the visitor center, the cattle crawl with the culvert, the chicken run, a swimming pool, an amphitheater, McGee area, some of the extensive paving and the relocation of neighbors who used to form part of the original homestead. 10.3.3 on page 6, measures that are not expressly provided for, but could have been discretionally implemented in a manner that benefits the broader community. And this includes the helipads, the private clinic, whose role in her view could have been fulfilled by a mobile clinic and of vital capacity at the local municipal medical facility. These measures also include the construction within state occupied land of permanent, expensive, in her view, one-room top staff quarters, which could have been located at a centralized post station. So this gives an idea of, firstly, what the public protector considers as non-security features, their reasons for coming to that conclusion. Paragraph 14, I say I refer the committee to page 42 of the public protector's report. In particular, paragraph 1, where one gets an idea of how the public protector got to eliminate the non-security, what in her opinion are non-security features. And this is what she says. All I did here was to ascertain from the relevant state actors what the proximity of such non-listed measures to the list in the minimum security measures and the list prepared in pursuit of the security evaluations. What she's saying here is there was a list that was prepared by SAS, and that this list contained what, according to her, are the security, as they say, a security feature. So if or anything that is not that list, and she does not give a satisfactory explanation as to why it must be a security feature, she would then come to a conclusion or a view that it is not a security feature. The, on page 15, it deals with the private clinic helipads. She says she found no reason why these were located near the private residence rather than at a central place that could benefit the entire impoverished Ngala community. Now, having, because this, it will seem, because if the state is to pursue an undue enrichment claim, and we need to call witnesses, and so she would then be the person who would then have made these calls. The question, I mean, paragraph 16 on page 7, indicated to the committee that, in my view, what constitutes security enhancement can probably be determined by security effects. In Kinturiko AG versus Festo SAPTY Limited, this is a 1972-11 essay, 589 appellate decision at 616. The court referring to a Wigmore principle of evidence, 3rd edition, volume 7, paragraph 1923, stated that the true and practical test of the admissibility of the opinion of a skilled witness is whether or not the court can receive appreciable help from that witness on a particular issue. In Seisi versus the State, this is an unreported case of the SCA, where Shipley J.A., the 2012 decision, said the following regarding expert witnesses. So expert witnesses are in principle required to support their opinions with valid reasons, but no hard fast rules can be laid down. Much will depend on the nature of the issue involved and the presence or absence of an attack on the opinion of the expert. When the expert personally conducted experiments, it is easy for the court to follow the evidence, accept it, and rely on it in deciding the issue. Paragraph 17, it is common cause that the public protector is not a security expert. That much she has accepted in her report. It is also apparent that the Cabinet Memorandum of 2003 outlines 10 steps to be followed when security measures are to be installed at the private residence, the sitting president, deputy president, former presidents, and deputy presidents. I'm not going to rehash those 10 steps. If the committee is well within its, I think the committee is familiar by now of these 10 steps. But what is imperative about these 10 steps is that all the reports on this matter are agreed that these steps, most of these steps, weren't complied. Even those that were complied weren't not complied fully. Note that the second step in particular relates to the foundation, the SAPS and DP, SAPS and SSA need to look at the, there has to be an assessment and the evaluation of the needs. Needs analysis. All of this never took place in the current situation. There is a report or the evaluation done by SAPS, and it would not, it would appear that SA did not play a role as is required by the standard memo. The all the reports are agreed that the reason for the challenge that the committee is faced with could be attributed, amongst others, to non-compliance with particular cabinet memorandum. And it is therefore then a bit of a challenge for myself when the person making these calls is not a security expert. Secondly, security experts as per the memorandum are not solicited to conduct the necessary security analysis and identify what then would qualify as a security and what would qualify as a non-security. The press is, stand with all these security threats, and it is still possible to have security aspects looking at the premises and determine what out of these features qualify the security enhancements and which ones do not. But on the basis of the public protector's finding, it is my respectful submission and also that the public protector is not a security expert. So after the security expert advice on what constitutes security and non-security features in respect of the upgrades, tackled by the failure to comply with the 10 steps, which were amongst others aimed at exactly identifying what the security upgrades should be, I respectfully submit that it will be very difficult for the state to succeed in discharging its onus of proving undue enrichment on the balance of probabilities. Therefore, in my view, it would be premature for the committee to make a finding of undue enrichment prior to the matter having been attended to by the relevant security experts consistently with the cabinet memo of 2013.
I think it's 2003.
It's 2003. In paragraph 20, I do make a recommendation to the committee that it considers regarding the matter of specifically what constitutes security and not security upgrades by the cabinet to be determined by the relevant security experts in line with the cabinet memo of 2003. That is in respect of the merits, and that is advice. It is committee might decide against that. It is within the discretion of the committee. The last, and which was the second issue, the determination of the quantum in respect of undue enrichment claims. There's reference to the Kudu Granite case, which was quoted earlier on, and it is important because it tells you how you go about determining quantum. The Honorable Justices of the Appeal Court, NAFSA J.A. and Yer J.A., stated that the quantum of the enrichment, of the undue enrichment, is the lesser between the two. It's the lesser of either the amount by which the party benefiting has been enriched. or the amount by which the other party has been impoverished. If we come back to the particular case, stakes has spent roughly in excess of 216 million. And let's say, for argument's sake, that 115 million of that 216 is found that it did not relate to security upgrades. That is what the impoverished party, in other words, the state, that is what the state would have lost. The other amount that you look at is the amount by which the party benefiting has been enriched. Now, the because if the party benefiting only received the enrichment of or in the value of 10 million. In terms of this judgment, the amount to be paid would not be 155 million, but it would be 10 million. In this particular case, the issue of cost escalations plays a determining factor around the eventual amount that will be paid. That is my advice to the committee on the two issues that I was requested. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Advocate Zanara. I will now open up for comment and questions from the committee. Honourable Kubai.
Thanks, Chairperson. I think the legal opinion is assisting, and I think would be able to make recommendations. I wouldn't want to engage at this point because it just enhances our work and gives us a better perspective on certain issues, and would be able to analyze it when it comes to the issues of the findings and the recommendation. But just say to Advocate Zanara, some of us battle with Africa. I'm sure there's a paragraph there. I couldn't read and understand what you were saying. So I might come offline to just check what exactly is it saying there.
I almost requested him to read it in Afrikaans to us, Honorable Kubai, to avoid Asians being lost. Yeah. Is there any other comment, honorable members? Thank you, Advocate, for that input. I will request you to stay here. Since we will have to, as a committee, decide as we go into the findings, because this opinion was not available when these findings were drafted out of the discussions of the previous committee, and I had a discussion with the content technical expertise on exactly what they say. The document in terms of the findings, honorable members, is in front of you. And the findings, what has happened is that, and we must decide on the format of this report because there's useful headings, but sometimes the headings does not necessarily speak to the findings that's in there, and it could be completely misinterpreted of what we try and say. We want consistency throughout. It assists. The drafters, it definitely assists in terms of expecting what to follow, but there's other issues that arise. The first finding deals with the steps taken by the President since the issue dealing with the security upgrades at the private residence in Kandla became very topical, and investigations started, and it basically refer to the previous observations that were made in terms of the different steps that the President has undertaken. But the committee must comment thereon. There's no clear, I don't see the finding from the draft is very clear. It is hidden in there somewhere, and I want it to be more explicit. The Honourable Kubai.
Thanks, Chairperson. This is the point I made in the last meeting. That this part should be towards the end. I don't know if you remember that. where I asked that firstly let's start with the bigger, because we, if you follow the definition, we start by observing the process itself first, the role played by everyone, because the president's part comes for me just towards the end. So for me, it would start with the part of issues around non-compliance legislation and all those things as a first part. While I agree with you, if you look at this one, I don't know if I must get into it, and once we dealt with it, they would know how to put it. When you look at this one, for example, 4.1, I would request that it's not the evidence, it's the report before the committee, shows that the president, that paragraph, it needs to be reflected properly. Again, it's the issue that, as Chairperson is saying, also, there is no clear finding that is here, but if you are to go through, you know, the minute of public works announced the investigation, these are the steps that at the time also we had. Because the findings, I'm not so sure if it is acceptable as well, as at some point where we're making reference to certain document, we reference it to say we have made this observation and find based on this. Because it will help us, for example, on 4.1.4, there is a specific reference there, so that you are able to see it. But I wanted to begin on this one. On that one. But then the last thing in terms of the president's steps, with the topic says with regards to the efforts by the president made to investigate allegations related to the prestige project involving security upgrades as a private residence of the president and President Edinganza, the committee found. So you'd have to list what he has done, then make a pronouncement of our finding. Do we see this effort as sufficient as the committee? That the fact that there was a task input immediately, there was a proclamation of proclamation R59 of 2013 for the SRU, the task team reported, once the public protector replied. I think again there, we need to include the communication between the president and the speaker, the letters, that the letter was written in the speaker, because that's part of what we need to make a finding on. Because once that issue of 14 days response, we need to reflect on that as well. So we include that, the issues of letter, and then the issues on the 14th of August, the president reported to the National Assembly on the efforts he and government as a collective made to ensure that whatever state funds might have been lost due to the security upgrades could be identified and recovered, and that persons who were implicated through evidence were brought to book. And the finding, therefore, because out of this we need to say, therefore, the committee finds that the steps as listed above clearly indicates that there was action by the president in terms of immediately the issue that has come through. So that's I'll pop there and then come to the next one when we...
Okay, that entire paragraph deals with 4.1 deals with the matter that you go by first, and I agreed to come towards the end, because that basically summarizes everything that's in there. Is there a different view from other members of the committee? 4.2. See, once again, there's a heading. The 4.2 refers to the security cluster investigation report, states that the president did not request the security upgrades at the Sinkandla residence. Honorable Kubai?
So, Professor, again, the referencing is not correct here as well. You're finding this both in the public protector's report, you're finding this in the SIU report and the ministerial. So you've got to reference correctly this part as well. So that sentence is not correct. It needs to be referenced and made properly in terms of that. Do you want me to, or are we going step by step?
I'll take it step by step, yes.
So that's the
context.
Let me just say something. I view the first part, because the topic is with regards to non-compliance with relevant education and supply chain management policy that led to corrupt action and mass cost escalation. Oh no, you know, sir, I'll come, because it's a slide that I wanted to speak to. I'll come to the end of our session.
The 4.3 then, and even in that respect, Honorable Kubai, there needs to be clear reference in 4.2 to the relevant reports that you are referring to, so the finding is clear. It's not something that, that is manufactured. It is there in the different reports. 4.3 states that the security upgrades of the president's private residence should start with request by the president in the public protector on page 389 of the report, and the SIU on page 68, 69, and also 189 reported that Cabinet Memorandum states that the process of securing the President's private residence should be initiated with a request by the President, and this does not happen. Is there a comment on that, Honourable Members? If I can just comment in the meantime to say that even that point needs to be dealt with more clearer, because it deals with the initiation, what started, what kick-started the process, and we need to be clear in terms of that finding that needs to be made there. I think in one of the reports, it's a public protector report on page 20, referred to a normative process that kicked in, and that should be the correct reference, because a public protector refers to a normative process that started the process of security outlets. Honorable Kubai?
I have a bit of difficulty with this paragraph. If you remember the report, and that's what we observed as a committee, was that there was no clarity at some point which document, that's why you could find that the other one wanted to use the NK, what is it, Naval Key Points Act, the other one missed the cabinet. Because our finding should be that there isn't a clarity. I want to put it in the correct wording. Our finding would be that no document or no legal framework gives the authority in terms of the work. That's why we talked about the fragmented legislation. Not that you are making sense. And that's why I said I find it was only based on the cabinet memorandum. Why we agree that the process needed to be followed through the cabinet memorandum, but there was confusion. That's what I want to see. There was confusion from others, thinking that, or even through the public protector's report, it's the public protector's report that reflects that at some point it was it's through National Key Points Act. And that's why it needs to have so that when we talk about a comprehensive legislative that speaks to what needs to happen and how, because you would have found, but if it's one document that guided them, then it doesn't create that confusion. But because of what we have picked up through the discussion, that's what we have caused confusion. That's one thing that I'm not sure how to put it and to phrase it properly. Unless it becomes another paragraph beyond the vacant issue.
Do you want to respond to that?
I think on page 26, that is captured from 4.8 onwards.
Okay. Okay. 4.4. The reports contain no evidence that the President in any manner influenced the executive authority or officials who act in ways that suggested that they should have acted in corrupt ways while securing the private residence at Nkandla. 4.5.
Yes, Honourable Member. Same thing, referencing, because most of what is being said here, it's derived from reports. Otherwise, you run the risk. Because we start taking this from the report, you need to reference, this is the page of the public protector, this is the page of the SIU, this is the page of whoever else is speaking to this, and therefore, because we would have to substantiate, based on this report, we agree with the fact that the president has not influenced the process.
4.5, the introduction of Mr. Makanya to the DPWT was done because there were already plans in place for construction. Then the report reached further. If new plans were put in place, there was nothing. I don't agree with you. You expand on the finding that you're making. That next line that reads, if new plans were put in place, there was nothing irregular in introducing the teams, as the introduction of Mr. Makanya did not constitute an appointment. That is not necessary. Honorable Kubai?
I agree with you, Chairperson. It seems now that we are taking a stance as the committee in terms of this. It can be our view, and therefore I think that needs to be deleted. We shouldn't be found justifying or expressing unwarranted opinions where we shouldn't.
Those responsible for his labor appointment as principal agent knew the requirements of the legal, regulatory, and supply chain management framework, but did not follow these important precepts to the letter, and therefore it can be alleged that they acted illegally. 4.6.
Before you move, shouldn't we specifically state the PFMA? When we say which legal framework are we talking about? Because I think that in the report it's very clear. We're talking about treasury regulations, we're talking about PFMA, and then we're talking about supply chain management in terms of EPW.
It's noted. The private professional team was appointed in an irregular manner, and the ceding by the DPW officials of their responsibilities to Makanya and RNG consultants allowed for what the public protector calls project creep and massive corruption, which saw costs soaring to in excess of 216 million rand, as highlighted both in the public protectors and the SIU report.
Chairperson, therefore we express confirmation to this based on our discussion that both treasury regulation, supply chain management procedures, and PFMA was not followed by the officials, and therefore it exposed the government into this legal procedure.
I think we must use 4.6 together with 4.7. Mm-hmm. Let me do that. There was gross negligence on the part of senior officials and the acting directors general of the Department of Public Works. The officials who have acted outside of the legal and regulatory financial framework exposed themselves to the consequences as described in relevant legislation that gives effect to Section 216 of the Constitution, which is the Public Finance Management Act, National Treasury Practice Notes, and the DPW Supply Chain Management Policies. The instances where the executive authority did not adhere strictly to the prescripts regarding divisions of responsibility as per the Public Finance Management Act, and where the strain too close to the work of officials created a climate within which overzealous officials could have misinterpreted such involvement as further motivation to act outside the parameters of the existing legislative and regulatory framework. I think in terms of this, finding, we just need to ensure that the wording that we use, because it's referenced in the public protect report exactly to the same, exactly the same words as it appears here, so that we don't start interpreting what is in any of those reports. Yes?
Reading, I'm reading all the paragraphs 20, but we seem to be focusing, because remember, it's a security upgrade, and my understanding in terms of even on oversight, doesn't leave out the security people. For example, they call it the Director General, I'm not sure what now they use, but from staff and from defense, because they had a duty, all of them, in terms of oversight.
You just mention them again?
I'm saying, Chairperson, when you look at what you have read, it seems to be placing only the responsibility in DPW only. Whereas SAF and or police and the defense have a role to play, because they must oversee. I mean, I'm just imagining if you say you're putting a security feature and there's no subscription to qualify to make sure that this security feature meets the necessary requirements. That's what I'm saying, in a process, because once you start naming all, I think we need to do that. Not only DPW negligence is on the side of the appointment process, procurement process of Makanya and the team, but monitoring of the project as well comes to SAFS as well as defense.
That's an important point. It's a very important point. You want to comment on that?
Yes, sir. I think the Honourable Guy is absolutely correct here.
the actual point that brings SAPS in is actually 4.9. But what you correctly give us, Honourable Member, is that we should actually stay SAPS, and both SAPS SSA, State Security Agency, and South African National Defence Force. Because this will be linked to later findings, I suspect, Chair, will, whatever recommendations the committee come up with, strengthen that aspect of executive authority to hand it over to DPW, but did not do the monitoring.
As okay. Yes.
It's not only on, because Chapter 9, 4.9 speaks only about executive authority. There's got to be executive authority and administrative authority. The accounting officers of this department together with executive authority.
Okay. 4.9. Everyone come with me. There was a lack of sufficient oversight and monitoring by the executive authority of departments of public works and the South African Police Services, as they were called at the time, over how policy was implemented to its desired policy outcomes as prescribed in the PRMA. Honourable Kubani, your comment on 4.8 also applies to this instance. So you've referred to the executive authorities of public works, police, defence and state security. 4.10. And also the heading there must be changed. Because in terms of our discussions, I will point out now why it is not, it doesn't fit in there. The finding is the current legislative and regulatory measures related to the installation of security features at residence, such as political office bearers, are fragmented and inconsistent. That is what the report says. It then goes further, and it says that the National Key Points Act is out of sync with the current constitutional and legislative dispensation. Yes.
So, Chairperson, maybe if we can just comment on 411 and 412, where they are. I think there's general agreement about 411, but whether it should be there is a question. I don't think so, because remember again, the Cabinet Memo of 2013 is the guiding principle. And,
of 2003.
Yeah. Sorry, I've been influenced there by the Parliament Legal Advisor. But I think 412, we should really put it in the correct context, because I think, and ISA Europol is quite diplomatic in a certain sense of saying, well, in a certain sense, you know, with due respect, it shouldn't have been used as a guiding principle. But I think the fundamental difference between the public protector, the task team, and the SA report is the applicability of the National Key Point Act in the security upgrade at the President's private residence. So the SIU, and I think that's important, the SIU and the task team found that the National Key Point is not applicable as the upgrades were affected in terms of the Cabinet policy in 2003. So I think BESA committee should be very clear in terms of the precedent of 2004, where the previous committee said, we concur, we note. There is no way in which this could be applicable, and I think some of the reports strayed the wrong way with regard to that. So I think we must be very clear that the security updates were done in terms of the cabinet policy of 2003, and the last key point is not relevant. I mean, there's been a lot of reference to that, and the applicability, I think, especially in the PP's report and one other report, but that's really not relevant for our proceedings and our fines and eventually recommendations as well.
Just on that, I don't think we should remove it completely, because if you are to go to the report, it's reflected upon. Why are we Honourable Vietman? But we can't ignore that at some point it caused confusion. Its existence as a piece of legislation gave rise to the part of confusion that is there. What I think in the rephrasing of how he is putting it, that there is a need for, we have observed that the upgrade has been done as per the cabinet memo, but the main key points like caused a bit of confusion, and I would agree that it needs to feature so that we can be able to make recommendations as Parliament for that legislation to be changed.
Honourable Chair.
No, I think
Absolutely.
Yes,
4.12 reads, the National Key Points Act of 1918, and that's for funding, was not the applicable piece of legislation that guided the security upgrades of the President's residence at Mpanza. That's clear. It then goes further to say that the Cabinet Memorandum of 2003 is the appropriate policy document that should have guided the process of securing the private residence of the President. However, only two of these prescribed steps in that memorandum were followed. That's clear. 4.14, there was a lack of oversight by the executive authority of the Department of Public Works, the South African Police Services, the South African National Defence Force, and you should add state security because we're dealing with a state security matter, to ensure proper departmental coordination in compliance with the Cabinet Memorandum of 2003. Is everyone in agreement with that? Regular security assessments, as stated in the Cabinet Memorandum of 2003, were not performed by the South African Police Services under which the relevant state security entities function. Yes, all members?
I think we should go back to the consistency. It's all these departments. They needed to work in coordination of, they needed to coordinate the work, all of them.
Yes, we'll cross-check that exactly with what the Cabinet Memorandum says. Yes, sorry.
Jefferson, I would suggest that one stays as is because it refers to ongoing security assessments even after constructions are done. But what I would suggest to ourselves as technical team is that we don't just say SA Police Services and refer to relevant state security entities. We should actually name the state security agency specifically. Thank you, Chair.
Where does the issue of the initial arrestment fall? I understand this one is a regular security assessment.
Yes, in terms of the observations, we dealt with that point. And also in terms of input by the legal advisor. That's why the input that Advocate Venara gave in terms of also where the initial assessment refers to that. That should be incorporated into the document. Now, it is not there, as I indicated. This legal advice, it literally came with Advocate Venara when we were in a meeting here. So that is not in the document, and we have to ensure that it is incorporated and factored into the appropriate parts of the document.
Okay. Let me just recommend if it can come before the regular security assessment, it becomes the initial assessment was not properly done. Because both the reports of SIU and the PP have alluded to that, then it can come.
We'll cross-check it as well.
Yes, cross-check it as well.
The SIU, using the security requirements set out in the security assessment reports of SEPS and SNDF, issued a considered view that requires urgent attention. In the final 2 points of this report, points 46, should be paragraph 46 and 47, on page 247 and 248, it places urgency on the need for further security assessment by security experts from the State Security Agency, SEPS, and the SNDF. And there's a quotation, during the inspection in local, the investigating team noted a number of matters of concern relating to the upgrades that have been effected. Having regard for what was produced under Makanya's stewardship of the project and measuring it against what the security assessment report set out as requirements, in our respectful view, a further review by SEPS should be undertaken as soon as possible. Close quote. And that links in with 4.15 as well, that talks about the ongoing security assessments. And therefore, 4.17 refers to the matter where I required Edward Venara to look into in terms of legal advice dealing with who has the expertise to conduct security assessments of this nature. And I would suggest that the entire paragraph be rephrased and be aligned with the legal input that we have received. Agree? It deals with issues of security, non-security measures, and all those things that go with it. And then, in terms of the ownership of the land, 4.18,
We have two pieces of land that are under discussion here. The one belonging to the Zuma family, where houses were at different stages of completion, and the other belonging to the Nkonyama Trust. According to the report of the Public Protector Secure and Comfort, a bond was declared with the Registrar Member Interests. In his letter to the Speaker of the National Assembly, dated 14 August 2014, the President states that he holds permission to occupy, page 4 of the letter, as issued by the traditional authorities, and as such the land belongs to the Zuma family. Second piece of land, on which residences of settled families and other features were constructed, is administered by Nkonyama Trust. Resettlement of these families took place with the necessary permission of the traditional authorities. 4.20. As part of securing the President's private residence and to ensure that, in cases of emergency, there's a free and fast flow of traffic, various structures and amenities were moved from the President's land and constructed on the second piece of land. In terms of the question of whether the President was in violation of the Executive Members Code, and I think Mr. Kubai, that is where your point comes in, on the different steps that are going to take, because they have a finding. It needs to be connected with what you say early in the report. In light of what the steps that you have reported, the President is not in violation of the Executive Member Ethics Code. The committee is further satisfied that both the Public Protector's investigation and that of the FIU, and it is referenced there, did not find evidence that the President violated the Member's Executive Code. I also just need to cross-check this in terms of exactly what those two reports are saying, so that there can be clarity, absolute clarity around that finding. Okay. That is the last finding in front of us, honorable members, that we have processed, and I invite comments on the process and the way forward. Honorable Zakude.
I think we need to allow the content advisor to further clean up the documents, clean up the findings, before we can zoom into recommendations, because we want those recommendations flow from the findings. So if we can allow them a space to do such work.
Honorable Kubai.
I second the Deputy Chief, Chair, but I'm just thinking that we should have a meeting as soon as possible so that we are able to analyze this. For me, it's more around how we structure this. Once we have the findings, give us direct recommendations almost, because it could be how these are phrased in the manner that we have requested, so that for us to be able to say these are the recommendations, I think that would assist us very much, Chair.
Okay. Honourable members, what we will then do is to ask the technical team, that is all the content advisors, together with the senior legal advice from Parliament, Edward Venara, to immediately start working on the improvements and the amendments that have been affected. It's quite a number of amendments, and especially emphasis on the presentation that we have received from Advocate Venara, so that we get a draft of this report and make proposals for recommendations. The committee must report to the National Assembly by next Friday. And I hear what the Honourable Kubai is saying about meeting earlier, or as soon as possible. Do you have a specific proposal, Honourable Member?
President, can we meet on Tuesday next week in the morning?
Tuesday,
so that we really finish the work. We shouldn't wait for Friday.
The second of that proposal will then meet on Tuesday morning. The time and the venue will be communicated, and then we will deal specifically with the recommendations, and I will strive to get that first clean-up report with the findings to you before that meeting, so that in the meeting we are clear in terms of what we're proposing. That brings this meeting to an end, and you will be duly informed of when the committee will be sitting. The meeting is now closed.
Thank you.